Well, good evening. As you are aware, we're in Job chapter 38 and right through to the beginning of chapter 40. We're not going to read the whole passage, but we will read sufficient excerpts to get the sense of what is being said in the passage. And we'll start with Job chapter 38 and verse 1. Job chapter 38 and verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb?" Down to verse 12. "Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place?" Verse 16. "Have you entered the springs of the sea? Or have you walked in search of the depths?" Verse 19. "Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place?" Verse 22. "Have you entered the treasury of snow? Or have you seen the treasury of hail?" Verse 25. "Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water? Or a path for the thunderbolt? To cause it to rain in a land where there is no one? A wilderness in which there is no man?" Verse 29. "From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth?" Verse 31. "Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth in its season? Or can you guide the great bear with its cubs?" Verse 34. "Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightnings that they may go and say to you, 'Here we are'?" Verse 39. "Can you hunt the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions?" Verse 41. "Who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth?" Verse 5 of chapter 39. "Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager?" Verse 9. "Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger?" Verse 13. "The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly stork's?" Verse 19. "Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder?" Verse 26. "Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high?" Chapter 40, verse 1. "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, 'Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it.' Then Job answered the Lord and said, 'Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further.'" We look to the Lord to add his blessing to what we've read. So in this section, Job gets what he asked for a long time ago. Here's Job, and we've spent many weeks dwelling on his suffering. Absolutely awful suffering. Someone who lost close to everything and suffered dreadfully. Back in chapter 13, in verse 22, we read of him saying this: "Then call, and I will answer," he's addressing God, "or let me speak, then you respond to me." Job wanted an audience with God. He suggested that God would let Job speak, and then God would give his response. God would give his answer. But perhaps what we have here is not quite the way Job might have imagined it. Job certainly wasn't going to be cross-questioning God here. It's the other way around. The Lord asks Job question after question. Over 70 questions, so I'm told, haven't counted them. And Job, as we were reminded there from Paul, would be left pretty much speechless, with nothing to say. See, sometimes people who aren't believers get the idea that God has to justify himself to them. They say things like this. They say, what right does God have to tell me what to do? There was a pop star back in the 90s who said something like this. He was falling into the trap that several pop stars have over the years of getting a bit too big for his boots. And he said this in an interview back in the 90s. If there is a God, I'll have a few things to say to him on Judgment Day. Yes, sometimes the arrogance of man. And the arrogance of man is demonstrated in the words of some non-Christians, some unbelievers such as that pop star, think that they're going to put God in the dock. And they're going to cross-question God. And they're going to make God give the answers. And I suppose the challenge for us is it possible that sometimes something of that attitude creeps into our mind? Something of that attitude that requires that God justifies himself and explains and justifies his actions to us. Now, the last thing I want to do this evening is be critical of Job. Because as we've looked at what he's suffered, and as we've looked at his patience in response, I would not dare be critical of Job and his response. What we just must look at ourselves and ask, is there ever that possibility that sometimes we think we want to demand answers, explanations from God? Now, it's very interesting what we don't read here. We might have expected to have opened up chapter 38 and seen something like this. We might have expected to see God saying something like, well, Job, what happened was Satan came to me and said that if you lost everything, you'd curse me. So I told him that all that you had was in his power, but he had to spare your life. And that's the explanation for all that's been going on. We might have expected to see that. We might have expected to read that explanation. The remarkable thing, or one of the many remarkable things in this passage, is that that's not what we read. We don't read of Job being given that explanation. We don't read it in chapter 38. We don't read it in chapter 39. Or 40, or 41, or 42. We don't read Job being given that explanation. And that can be difficult to get our heads around, but let's look at what Job does get. Job gets a series of many questions that reveals something of God's greatness. And the Lord speaks to Job, verse 1 of chapter 38, out of the whirlwind. Sometimes, as in this passage, God speaks out of the whirlwind. Sometimes, as in 1 Kings chapter 19, God speaks in the still small voice. Remember that one with Elijah? 1 Kings 19, verses 11 to 14. And the Lord passed by. A great and strong wind tore into the mountains and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. But here, in the book of Job, as God was about to reveal something of his greatness, he first demonstrates his majesty in the whirlwind. And there can be something awesome about a storm, can't there? I took this picture in the summer in the south of France. This is the, I don't know if anyone recognises where it is. This is the Verdon Gorge. It's basically Europe's answer to the Grand Canyon. It's spectacular. It's magnificent. It's massive. Just a few moments before I took that photo, I had stood outside the car with my camera videoing as thunder echoed all around and as lightning flashed. Maybe I was crazy standing out and videoing it, but it was awesome. It really was absolutely awe-inspiring as you looked at the handiwork of God and you heard something just that was altogether bigger than us. Out with our control, out with our power. And we're going to look tonight at the greatness and work of God. We'll look at that in two sections. First of all, we'll look at lessons from creation and nature. If you like, inanimate objects is really what we're going to be focusing on from verses 4 to 38 of chapter 38. Then we're going to look at lessons from the animal kingdom in the remainder of chapter 38 and through chapter 39. 10 lessons from each. Don't worry, we'll not spend too long on any one lesson. And if we do, we'll catch up somehow. So let's look first of all at lessons from creation and nature. And what's the first question that we're going to focus on here? Question number 1 from verses 4 to 7. The Lord asks Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" Where were you, Job? Were you there? Surely you were there, the Lord's saying. You know, if you've got understanding, you must have been there when I created the world, when I put it all in place, when I, fastened its foundations, stretched the line upon it. You know, surely, Job, you must have been there, were you not? It's amazing, actually, today, isn't it, how many people think they know better than the one who was there. I wasn't there, none of us were there. But God was there, and he's recorded it all in his word. And yet today it's amazing how many folks think that they know better than God about how it all came to be. Well, of course, we read in Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 to 17. "For by him, the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things consist." It's remarkable as well, as we make new discoveries, as we discover more about the world around us, and yes, science has discovered a lot, but there's a lot we still don't know. Isn't it amazing that we can just be lost in wonder at what God has done? Here's something amazing that I found. I don't want to mislead you and take this out of context. Verse 7 talks about morning stars singing together and the sons of God shouting for joy. In context, it's generally, the consensus would be that that's probably angels that's speaking to. Do you know what they discovered in 1967? They discovered that stars do indeed sing. Well, they kind of sing. Let me tell you a wee bit more and I'll explain it to you. Pulsars, pulsating stars, apparently they're highly magnetised rotating stars. They emit electromagnetic radiation. So in 1967, November the 28th, there's a lady called Jocelyn Bell Burnell. She's doing her PhD, and she and Anthony Hewish discover these pulsars. They discover emissions from them that are separated by precisely 1.33 seconds. They can't work out where they're coming from. They say that the fact that they're so regular and so precise, this isn't man-made radio frequency interference. They check it out with another telescope, check it's not the instrument that's at fault and it's generating it. And they don't know what it is. They think, is this some other civilization trying to communicate with us? And they're saying, well, we didn't really think that, but we're starting to wonder, could it be that? They started to actually name the stars, these pulsars, LGM-1 and so on. LGM stood for Little Green Men. So they, with their tongue slightly in their cheek, they wondered what it was. And then they discovered that these stars were actually making these signals, making this noise. Now, I've got a recording of them. I don't know if it's connected up to an external speaker, so I don't know how well this will come out, but this is different pulsars, all from a cluster of stars called 47 Tucanae, apparently. 100,200 trillion miles away from us, 720 trillion miles across, and various of them are emitting these pulses that can be recorded and detected by us. Well, do you call it singing or not? We'll not get tied up too much on the logistics. But you know the other thing that's amazing about this, about these pulsars? They're the most precise atomic clocks you'll ever get. the frequency at which they emit their pulses, they're apparently more precise than the best clocks, watches, whatever that you can get. And that's amazing. Now, I don't know anything about astronomy other than what I've read in a little bit, in a few books, and a wee bit on the web. So that's my entire knowledge on the subject, pretty much. Some of you here may know far more than I do about that. But who did all that? Who put it all there? God did it. Isn't it amazing as we discover more about our world, our universe, everything around us? Here's what one professor of chemistry, Professor Henry Fritz Schaefer, professor from the University of Georgia, here's what he had to say. The significance and joy in my science comes in those occasional moments of discovering something new and saying to myself, so that's how God did it. And isn't it amazing that we can wonder as we look at things like that, things that God has put into place and things that God has got operating with better precision than we could ever make with our best man-made instruments and machines that go ping and so on and so forth. God made it all. He created the earth. He knows everything about it. And if we can't even start to get to grips with how God created the earth, how much should we trust him to do what's right when it comes to spiritual and moral matters? Sometimes we don't understand. You know, we don't understand. I don't understand all of this. I can quote a few lines that I've read, and that's about it. We don't understand how God's workings in creation and in the universe. But we look at it and we just stand back in awe and wonder at what he's done. And there's no doubt much more that we haven't yet discovered. And we say, if he can do all that, we can trust him. We can trust him even when we don't understand. Okay, we better go on with some more questions. Question 2, chapter 38, verses 8 to 11. Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, this far you may come but no further, and here your proud waves must stop. Who, God asks, who established the boundaries of the sea? I'm just showing you all my holiday photos tonight, aren't I? Except the one before that wasn't my holiday photo. But this was Embo Beach, which is up in Sutherland. Maybe Andrew knows some of this bit, because there's a wee bit pasture, such a neck of the woods. But we had a holiday here in October. We had a caravan right on the beach. That was the view standing in front of the caravan window. And of course, it looks idyllic. And one thing that you haven't bargained for is when the waves are fairly crashing in and the tide's coming in and you're trying to get to sleep at night, it takes you a couple of nights before you get used to that. But by the third night or thereabouts, we were used to it. But how come, as the waves were come crashing in, as the tide was advancing, how come we could go to bed knowing that the tide wasn't just going to keep on going and forget to turn? How could we go to bed and know that the tide wasn't going to come and that we weren't going to be sailing away down the road to Dornoch or whatever in the morning? Well, the tides follow a pattern. You can look up tables, you can find out when the tide's going to be high, when the tide's going to be low. We know where it comes up to. We know where it goes back to. We know all these things. Who made it that way? Who did it? Who put it all there? Who established the boundaries of the sea? God did. Question 3, verses 12 to 15. Have you commanded the morning since your days began, and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth, and the wicked be shaken out of it? It takes on form like clay under a seal, and stands out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the upraised arm is broken. Who controls the dawn? Do you control the dawn? God says, have you commanded the morning since your days began? There's the sun rising over Aberdeen Harbour. I didn't take that photo. I looked out my window this morning as the sun was rising over Prime 4. And I took a photo of that but decided I wouldn't show you that one. It rose at 8:40 this morning. Tomorrow, It'll rise at 8:39. When we go to bed tonight, we don't need to worry. Will the sun rise tomorrow? And what's more, we can't control it. If we decide that it would actually be quite convenient tomorrow if the sun rose at 6 o'clock, there's nothing that we can do to make it rise at 6 o'clock unless we want to change our clocks to synchronise with when it's going to rise anyway. We can't control the time of the sunrise. Who controls it? God does. Question 4, verses 16 to 18. Have you entered the springs of the sea? Or have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. God asked Job, do you know what's under the sea? Have you walked in search of the depths? Have you been there? Of course, Job hadn't. He didn't know what was down there. Apparently, the deepest part of the ocean, the deepest known part of the ocean, I should add, as far as we know, the deepest part of the ocean, is this area called Challenger Deep. It's in the Pacific Ocean. It's part of what's known as the Mariana Trench, near the Mariana Islands. And it's just short of 11 kilometres deep. Okay? If you put Mount Everest on the bottom of the ocean bed, the top of it would be covered and there's still the 2 kilometres left. That's how deep it is. There's undoubtedly wonders under the sea, wonders that we will never see, that probably match anything that we can see, such as Mount Everest and so on. Isn't that amazing? There's only ever been 2 manned descents, 2 occasions where people have gone down to the bottom here. One in 1960 and one in 2012. The rest of us, we'll never see that. We'll never go down there. Job hadn't seen it. Who knows about it? Who put it there? Who knows if we've spotted the right point, that this is the deepest one? God knows. Because he made it all. Question 5, verses 19 to 21 of chapter 38. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place? That you may take it to its territory. That you may know the paths to its home. Do you know it because you were born then? Or because the number of your days is great? God's asking Job about the sun. Come on, Job. Where does the sun go at night? Where does it go when it's going to its home? Where does it go when it's going to bed? Where does the darkness go during the day? Come on, Job. You must know these things. You were around at creation, were you not? Oh, yeah. That's sort of what God's saying here. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place? That you may take it to its territory. That you may know the paths to its home. The sun. Here's something else that's mind-blowing. As I was reading this, and I was doing a bit of reading around it, I read a book called Indescribable. It's by Matt Redman and Louis Giglio. And it's got a whole load of facts. Double-checked some of them with a bit of Googling, and again, it's way beyond my level of knowledge, but it would appear to be reliable. And here's what they said about the sun, quoting a man called James Jeans. A pinhead, heated to the temperature of the centre of the sun, would emit enough heat to kill anyone who ventured within 1,000 miles of it. Okay. Or, if you want something else about the power of the sun, it would take the gross national product of the United States of America, so all the products and services that the US produces in a year, all the value of all that, that's probably quite a big number, I suspect. It would take the gross national product of the US for 7 million years. For your local power company to run the sun for 1 second. Now, I know energy prices are getting silly, but, you know, that just blows your mind, doesn't it? That's what our God can do when he put the sun there. Now, here's something else that's mind-blowing. Imagine Earth for the moment as being the size of a ping pong ball, table tennis ball. Here it is. So everything, the whole Earth, here, across to the States, right round, down to Australia, right round, over the Far East, Middle East, and back round, over Europe. Whole Earth, ping pong ball, okay? If Earth were the size of a ping pong ball, the sun would be 15 feet across, 15 feet in diameter. That's more than I can stretch. Okay, 15, quite a bit more than I can stretch. 15 feet in diameter. Okay, that's mind-blowing. There's a bigger star called Betelgeuse. I don't know if I'm pronouncing these right or not. Someone can correct me later if you know any, if you know details of this. 427 light years away. On the same scale, Earth, ping pong ball, Sun, 15 feet in diameter. Betelgeuse would be the size of 6 Empire State Buildings stacked on top of each other. I've never seen the Empire State Building, but I think it's pretty big. Okay, 6 of them on top of each other. That's Betelgeuse. Another star, really going to get into trouble pronouncing these names, Mukefii. This has something to do with heads, I suspect that. One of the largest stars in our galaxy. It would be as wide as 2 Golden Gate Bridges stretched end to end. So you've got Earth, ping pong ball, Sun, 15 feet, Betelgeuse, 6 Empire State Buildings on top of each other, Mukefii, 2 Golden Gate Bridges stretched end to end. Never been to San Francisco, I'm guessing it's big. And then there's another star, Canis Majoris, the big dog, 4,900 light years from Earth. On the same scale, it would be the height of Mount Everest. So Earth, ping pong ball, Sun, 15 feet, Betelgeuse, 6 Empire State Buildings, Mukefii, 2 Golden Gate Bridges, Canis Majoris, the height of Mount Everest. So we're starting to see that although our sun is big, and although our world seems like a big world, in the scale of the universe, we're pretty small, aren't we? We are pretty tiny. We're off the scale. You can't represent it there. Not even the size of a ping pong ball. Who made it all? Who did it? God did. Okay, next question. Question number 6. From the Lord to Job. Verses 22 to 24 of chapter 38. Have you entered the treasury of snow? Or have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? So who sends snow and hail? This was taken the week before last at Chicago O'Hare International Airport when the US was getting covered by that massive snow and ice caused by a polar vortex. And again, I can't even start to tell you what a polar vortex is, but it caused a lot of snow. And there you go, hailstones. That was all from the US, not in the past week or two. Hailstones the size of golf balls. Of course, God can use these things for his purposes. And God used hail for his purposes. In Exodus chapter 9 and verses 18 to 26, we read, as Pharaoh's heart is hardened and won't let the children of Israel go from Egypt, and one of the plagues that God sends in Exodus 9 verse 18, behold, tomorrow about this time I will cause very heavy hail to rain down, such as has not been in Egypt since its founding until now. Therefore send now and gather your livestock and all that you have in the field, for the hail shall come down on every man, and every animal which is found in the field is not brought home, and they shall die. And then in Joshua we read of another occasion where the Lord used hail for his purposes, in Joshua chapter 10 and verse 11, when we read that as they fled before Israel and were in the tent of Mount of Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down large hailstones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than the children of Israel killed with the sword. The awesome power of our God. There was not one thing that the people of America could do last week to turn this around. They had to close the schools. They had to close the interstate highways. They had to close it all. And they just had to sit and wait until milder weather came. The president of the US couldn't announce that this snow was to stop. He didn't try, I'm sure. But it would have been pointless, wouldn't it? The most powerful man in the world. And what could he do as his country was paralysed by snow and ice? Not a thing. Who controls it all? God does. Okay, rain and lightning. Question 7, verses 25 to 28. Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass? Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? Can we control the rain or the lightning? This was photographed in Aberdeen, I think it was last year, wasn't it? Can we control the rain or the lightning? If it rains one day and it's getting inconvenient, can I go out and say, stop? Well, I could, but it wouldn't have any effect whatsoever. I'd just get a bit wet and look a bit silly, wouldn't I? Likewise with lightning. Can we control the rain or the lightning? Can we decide when it rains and when it doesn't? Of course we can't. Who controls it? Who does it? God does. Question 8, verses 29 to 30. From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? The waters harden like stone and the surface of the deep is frozen. Who makes the ice? This was photographed again last week. Niagara Falls. Frozen. Isn't that amazing? Niagara Falls. So powerful. You know, millions and millions of gallons of water thundering over there. And there it was. Frozen. Not often that happens. And was there anything that they could do to change that? Not a bit of it. If they decided to freeze Niagara Falls at some other time, could they have done it? No. Who does it? God does. Question 9. Can you control the stars and planets? Verses 31 to 33. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth in its season? Or can you guide the great bear with its cubs? What are the many things that I love about living up here? Is you get lovely, clear nights. Clear skies. And you can come out your car when you get home from work or from the meeting or wherever it is you've been. And you can look up for a minute. And you can look up and you can see, yeah, there's the plough, part of the Great Bear, there it is there, there's the plough there. And you can look, and that's about the only one I can ever recognise is the plough. And you can see there's lots of other stars. And then you look and there's more! And you just go, wow! And part of you wants to just lie on your back and look up at the sky and look at it. And then you remember you're in your driveway and then, you know, someone might think you were a bit silly if you did that. So you go inside and you get taken up with other things. But there we go, the Pleiades. Apparently that's also called the Seven Sisters. It's among the nearest star clusters to Earth. The cluster most obvious to the naked eye in the night sky. Then there's Orion over here. There's the belt of Orion here. Another constellation. And the middle part is called Orion's Belt. And then the Great Bear, Ursa Major, with the plough there. Or the Big Dipper, as it's sometimes called. There it is. A useful pointer, apparently, towards the north. So I'm told. So we can spot them. People who are more knowledgeable than I am about the stars can say more than, oh, there's the plough. They can look and they can say, well, what is going to be seen at what particular time of year? Where is it going to be seen? And they can point it all out. And it's fascinating. We can tell when they'll appear. But you know what? We can't control them. If I decided, or any one of us decided, well, actually, I'd quite like it if the plough was over in the south tonight. Then it would still be where it always was. There'd be nothing I could do to control that. If I wanted to control what stars were visible at what time of year, nothing I could do about that. Who controls all that? Who set it all in motion? Who's in control of it all? God is. Finally, for this section, the clouds. Verses 34 to 38. The Lord asks Job, can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the mind? Or who has given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Or who can pour out the bottles of heaven? When the dust hardens in clumps and the clods cling together. These clouds were photographed apparently just outside Aberdeen. They were spotted by someone in Kinkorth last year. And they were called UFO clouds. They hit the news. UFO clouds, they may not be out of this world, the news story read, but these UFO clouds certainly made onlookers in Aberdeen wonder. However, weather experts said any thoughts that the sky signaled an impending alien invasion were pie in the sky. Lenticular clouds, as they are called, are formed when stable moist air flows over a range of mountains. Claire Stewart, 37, of Kinkorth, Aberdeen, made the sighting while looking out over her back garden in Kinkorth, Aberdeen, on Monday morning. She said, I was just looking out from my home in Kinkorth when I saw the cloud. It looked like a UFO, and I had to double take before I realised it was actually a cloud. Obviously, UFO sightings are commonplace. It seems like she was much more astounded to see it was a cloud. I've never seen anything like it before, but apparently they're called lenticular clouds. And the Met Office spokeswoman was then quoted, and she explained how that these clouds formed at heights between 6,500 feet and 16,500 feet. They're called lenticular because of their lens shape. Who controls the clouds? Can we do anything to affect the cloud formations and what appears where? We can't. Who controls the clouds? God does. Okay, now we're moving on from lessons from the inanimate world, from creation and nature. We're now moving on to 10 lessons from animals. And God has many more questions for Job. First of all, the lion. We're at the end of chapter 38 now, verses 39 to 40. Can you hunt the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens, or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Could Job feed the lions? I wouldn't fancy it personally, and I'm sure neither would Job. He couldn't find food for lions. He wouldn't want to put himself in that position of going up to the lion and saying, here's your food. I wouldn't fancy that. But you know, the amazing thing is that in addition to creating all that we have just heard of, and many more things besides, and controlling it with atomic precision, God is also looking after and feeding his creatures. He's providing food for the lions. Question 2, who feeds the raven? Verse 41 of chapter 38. Who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Ravens eat a variety of things, apparently. They'll eat plants, they'll eat animals, they'll scavenge, they'll feed on carrion, they'll do whatever it takes. And it's interesting, actually, because of course we hear of ravens again in the New Testament, don't we? Luke chapter 12 and verse 24, where the Lord Jesus said this to his disciples. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? You know, if by this stage we're feeling pretty insignificant, well, we'd be right, wouldn't we? We'd be right as we look at the greatness of God. And we look at how tiny our planet is by comparison, and how tiny we are by comparison. But, and we'll come back to this just shortly again, the mind-blowing thing is that that God who created all that universe, set it all in place, set it all in motion, controls it all with precision greater than man can ever achieve, he feeds the ravens, and he cares for us. And he provides for us. And that is pretty mind-blowing. Okay, wild mountain goats next. Chapter 39 and verse 1. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? You know, there are no vets or farmers for the wild mountain goats. No Aberdeen Maternity Hospital for wild mountain goats. Nobody there to look after the wild mountain goats, but they give birth. And it all happens. And it all keeps on happening. And then there's nobody there to tell the wild mountain goat, here's when the offspring are ready to leave home. And who delivers the wild mountain goats? I couldn't help with that. Job couldn't help with that, could he? And yet God has set all these things in place and ordered it all that these things happen with no intervention from humankind, nobody there providing any veterinary help or anything like that. And yet it all still happens. Who delivers the deer? Chapter 39, verses 1 to 4. Well, again, there's nobody out there on the moors. There's nobody out there, no vet, nobody else out to help the deer when they're giving birth, out to look after them and tell them when it's time to, for them to leave home. God has made it that way. Question 5. Who made the wild donkey, or onagon as apparently it's sometimes known, wild? Verses 5 to 8. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager? Onagers, according to Wikipedia, are notoriously untamable. You can't tame them. Who made it that way? Could Job tame the wild donkey? Could I tame a wild donkey? I don't fancy trying that one either. Who made it that way? God did. Okay, what about the wild ox? The our ox, as apparently it was known, it's now extinct apparently. Verses 9 to 12, will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? And the Lord asks Job a series of questions about the wild ox. What about if you get him to do some work for you, Job? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? Job couldn't control the wild ox. Far less should he or we try to control God. Then there's the ostrich, and there's a description of the ostrich in verses 13 to 18. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly. She waves her wings, but she can't fly. She leaves her eggs on the ground, and there she is, leaving her eggs on the ground. Sometimes you dig a bit of a deeper pit than that, apparently. She leaves her eggs on the ground. She treats her young harshly. Do you know, apparently it's the male who defends the hatchlings and teaches them to feed. Why did God make the ostrich that way? He doesn't tell us. It's not really up to us to ask, is it? He is God. He has made it that way. And it's his right to do so. Okay, what about the war horse? Verses 19 to 25. Who made the war horse courageous? Have you, the Lord asks, given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? And then it describes him going into battle and mocking at fear and not turning back from the sword. And then the trumpet has sounded. He doesn't come to a halt. At the blast of the trumpet, he smells the battle. He wants to get at it. Who made the war horse courageous? Not me, not Job. It was God. What about the hawk? How does the hawk fly and migrate? Do you make the hawk fly and migrate? Verse 26. Does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? I don't know if you saw on the news last week there a story about some scientists who had developed a tracking device. It weighs less than a paperclip, and they had attached it to a bird, not a hawk, but a red-necked phalarope, which apparently they're native to Shetland and the Western Isles. They're one of the UK's rarest birds. And they wanted to find out, where do they go when they migrate? So they tagged one of these birds and let it go on its migration, and then it came back, and they discovered that it had made a 16,000-mile round trip and come back to where it was. It flown from Shetland, across the Atlantic, via Iceland and Greenland, south down the eastern seaboard of the US, across the Caribbean and Mexico, ending up off the coast of Ecuador and Peru. It wintered in the Pacific, and then it returned to Shetland, following a similar route. Isn't that amazing? I couldn't find my way there. It was quite interesting when they showed the news story. They showed how much it would have cost one of us if we were trying to make that same journey by plane. And yet the birds do it. Who's made it that they can do that? Who did it? God did. Then there's the eagle. Do you make the eagle nest on high? Verses 27 to 30. The eagle builds its nest high up. It's got excellent eyesight. It can spy its prey. Who made it that way? God did. So at the start of chapter 40, the Lord sums it up. And here's what he says. Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. And the Lord's saying, Job, do you really want to try and correct me? Do you really want to rebuke me? Now again, I'm not going to be critical of Job. I think I've just, you know, it's really been quite amazing and astounding to have read of all that Job went through and of his patience in that situation. But here's the Lord saying, well, Job, it's not your place to correct me. It's not your place to rebuke me and tell me I've got it wrong. It's just not your place. Because the Lord's saying, I created all this. I control it all with that minute precision. Not only that, but I care for the individual. I care for the animals. I provide for them. Trust me to know that what I'm doing is right. And to accept that as God, He will do what is right. How does Job reply? Verses 3 to 5 of chapter 40. Job says, behold, I am vile. I am vile. The sense of the word apparently is insignificant. And he got it, hadn't he? Job had got it. I am vile. I am insignificant. And yes, he was. And so are we. That golf ball in the grand scheme of things. This photo is called the Pale Blue Dot. It's called the Pale Blue Dot. It was a photo taken by the Voyager spacecraft. The first ever external picture of our solar system. Apparently, so I'm told, it was 3.7 billion miles from home. And it looked back towards Earth. Can you spot it? See that pink, pale blue dot? That's Earth. That's everything on this world, everything that we've built up, everything that consumes our day-to-day lives. It's that pale blue dot. 0.12 of a pixel. Tiny fraction of one tiny component of this whole picture. And that's Earth. And we just say, wow. He's a majestic, sovereign, awesome God. He is God. And the thing that Job's getting to grips with here, he doesn't come in and say, but I've still not got my answers. He's not going to cross-question God now and what he's doing. He's not going to ask if God knows what he's doing. He's heard enough to realise that God does know what he's doing far better than any of us ever could. And Job is left quite literally almost speechless as he's given a glimpse of the greatness of God. So may we be lost in wonder at the greatness of our God. But you know what's truly astounding even more than all that? As we sometimes sing, it's when I think that God, his son not sparing, sent him to die, I scarce can take it in. That on the cross my burden gladly bearing, he bled and died to take away my sin. Then sings my soul, my Saviour God, to thee. How great thou art. Do you know what's amazing? Do you know what's amazing? An hour and a half ago, through in a hall just through the back there, we were able to sit together as an assembly of God's people and meet with that God who did all this and made all that and controls it all and pray to him and bring to him the matters that were on our heart and bring to him individuals that were on our hearts and bring to him requests and concerns. That's astounding, isn't it? That's amazing. How great is our God? Let's pray. Our God and our Father, as we think on your greatness, your majesty, your absolute awesomeness, words fail us. We realize that all our fancy instrumentation has only discovered probably a tiny fraction of what you have done and what you've put there. And yet what we know and what we've discovered makes us stand back and be lost in wonder and pretty much speechless. And we're amazed and we're astounded when we think that you, the God who created it all, you, the God who controls it all with minute precision, should care for us. Or that you should send your son to come to that planet Earth, that pale blue dot that we saw in that picture, to die for us, sinful men and women. We can't take it in. But we bow in wonder and we say, my God, how great thou art. Give us a sense of that wonder as we go from this place and go into a world that doesn't know him. Give us a sense of that wonder as we meet with people tomorrow who would perhaps mock at the very suggestion that there is a God. We long that others will come to know him. And we thank you that we can bring before you those who are on our hearts. Those who are going through particular times of difficulty just now. Would you remember Alistair Murray as he would go home in a couple of days, if it is your will, overrule and help him as he would take this step. We pray for all of your people who are in need of our prayers at the moment. We thank you that you hear and you answer our prayers. You, the Creator God, you, the God who created all things, you hear our prayers. And we thank you for that. In the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen.